problem throughout Wisconsin's smaller cities, towns, and villages. League Executive Director Jerry DeShane.
52% of the cities and villages overall say it's a problem, but in about two-thirds of cities and villages under 10,000 in population, you've got little or no competition for board and council seats. And in a lot of cases, too many cases, there's simply a blank spot on the ballot because nobody's interested.
DeShane says local government needs to adapt to the changing work and family demands of those who serve.
But the other thing, to be real blunt with you, we need to do a better job and a more thorough job of both telling our citizens why they have to be part of their government and, frankly, in a lot of cases, just plain asking them to serve.
In the village of Marathon City, Administrator Andy Kurtz says he thinks some people get turned off by the circus surrounding major office elections. Kurtz says local government is different, and it actually lets you get stuff done.
I would say they'd have far more impact at the local level. We have a board meeting, and we decide we're going to put up a stop sign. The stop sign goes up tomorrow. We decide we're going to buy a squad car. We're buying a squad car very quickly.
DeShane of the League of Municipalities says it's too early to say if declining participation means local government is in danger. But he worries the trend is heading in the wrong direction and says it needs to be dealt with. Rich Kramer, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Now 11 and a half minutes after 8, just a quick heads up, the WGTD morning show will start just a couple of minutes late today. The suspect in last Friday's shooting outside the TCF Bank on 22nd Avenue on Kenosha's north side has turned himself in. The Kenosha News reports that 43-year-old Rodney Coleman turned himself in at the police station yesterday afternoon. Coleman has been charged with attempted first-degree homicide in the shooting of a 25-year-old male bank employee that he thought was romantically involved with his girlfriend, who is also a bank employee. And in case you haven't heard enough about the Chicago Cubs World Series win last night, we're going to replay some of the stories from NPR's Morning Edition. Two teams, two baseball teams, two different stories last night. In Chicago, David Shaper reports on the Cubs' win. And in Cleveland, David Barnett talks to Indians fans about their loss.
The Cubs got off to a great start with leadoff hitter Dexter Fowler hitting a home run to start the game.
Yeah, baby! Yeah, baby! Yeah!
And the crowd at Bernie's, a bar across the street from Wrigley Field, exploding into cheers for that and every good play that followed. The Cubs led nearly the entire game, opening up what you would think is a comfortable three-run lead in the eighth. But this is the Cubs, and nothing is ever that easy. So soon, the wheels came off. Air left the room as the Indians' Rajay Davis hit a home run that tied the game. The jubilant faces in the bar suddenly tightened, becoming gripped with angst and fear. As the game went to extra innings, more anxiety because of a brief rain delay. But 55-year-old Tom McGee wasn't worried at all.
Don't worry about it. We got this.
How can he be so confident? I mean, this is the Cubs, after all, who have famously collapsed all throughout their history.
The old Cubs are gone. This is the new Cubs team. The new Cubs team doesn't collapse. Back against their wall, they battle back.
And battle back they did, scoring two runs in the 10th and hanging on to win by one run. Their first World Series championship since 1908. Even a half hour later, many Cubs fans stood in disbelief.
Very emotional right now.
While fighting back tears, 55-year-old lifelong Chicagoan and diehard Cubs fan Steve Urbach couldn't help but think of his friends and relatives who never saw the Cubs win a World Series.
And here I am experiencing it, and it's bringing back all these memories of them and the good times I had with them. And I just wish they were here.
The celebration spilled into the Chicago streets in and around Wrigley Field, where thousands of fans cheered, danced, kissed, hugged, and high-fived one another. That celebration is not likely to end soon, with plans for a city parade and a rally already in the works. David Shaper, NPR News, Chicago.
I'm David C. Barnett in Cleveland, where Cubs fans danced and high-fived in the corridors of Progressive Field as the Indians faithful silently filed out into the rain-soaked streets. The epic 10-inning game was largely dominated by Chicago. Every time Cleveland got some runs on the board, the Chicago hitters piled on more pain. Indians fan Chuck Smith says the game left him a nervous wreck.
So much up and downs that, emotionally, man, it'll rip you apart.
Still, he says it's important to keep things in perspective.
Yeah, the Cubs came out on top this year. That's cool. But for the most part, you know, it was a great experience, and that's what I look for. Win or loss, the experience is what counts.
Indians fan Cheryl Ricker stood under an awning outside Progressive Field with her friend Allison Heppe, a Chicago devotee. Ricker admits mixed feelings now that it's over.
I kind of thought they'd be the team to beat this year, believe it or not. I filled out my bracket, and I had the Cubs beating the Indians, so I wasn't too dumb, but my heart was with my tribe.
As the rain picked up, her friend Allison looked to the sky and cheered.
God's crying. He's so joyful. The Cubbies won. Yeah.
I think he's sad because
he's
the tribe lost.
He's happy. Tears of joy. That's what it is.
However you frame God's tears, one thing's certain. The World Series drought is over for the Cubs. Now the Indians, the new holders of baseball's longest series drought, are looking for a little rain. For NPR News, I'm David C. Barnett in Cleveland.
16 minutes after 8, just ahead of the slightly delayed WGTD Morning Show with Greg Berg. Let's check WGTD Sports and Weather, shall we? Well, you heard everything you need to know about the World Series game last night. In the NBA, the Bucks were off. The Bulls lost to Boston 107-100. Bulls are off tonight. The Bucks host Indiana. In the NHL, the Blackhawks will host Colorado tonight. Now the WGTD forecast from the National Weather Service for this Thursday, 3rd of November. Partly sunny and mild, high is 63, 40 tonight, sunny and 59 on Friday. Sun is shining now, lovely morning, 45 in Racine, 42 Kenosha, 38 for Burlington, Elkhorn and Lake Geneva. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. Just about 17 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for WGTD's morning show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenoshans who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Mr. Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago and later served as station manager and occasional morning show co-host. And we welcome you to the Thursday Morning Show on WGTD-HD. I'm Gregory Berg. Part one of today's morning show is with Dr. James Kinchin, Director of Choral Activities at the University of Wisconsin Parkside. Part two was supposed to be about a performance this weekend by the Bell Ensemble of Racine. Unfortunately, that interview, which has already been recorded, is not where it's supposed to be. So I've been looking desperately for it, and it looks like we will not be able to air that interview today. I will do some further searching later today. And I'm hoping we'll be able to bring that conversation to you tomorrow on the morning show. But we have something else for part two that I think you'll find interesting. But again, we're happy to welcome back to our studios Dr. James Kinchin from the University of Wisconsin Parkside. Dr. Kinchin, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Thank you, Greg. It's always a pleasure to be here with you.
Good to have you here, and I hope you're off to a good school year thus far at Parkside, and it sounds like your choral students have already been very busy preparing quite a major work that they are going to be performing this weekend. And it's a work by a composer whose name is completely unfamiliar to me. So I'm glad we have this opportunity for you to talk about it.
Yes. Well, the composer that you're talking about is Jose Mauricio Nunez Garcia. And we are performing his Requiem Mass of 1816. So to tell you a little something about Garcia, Nunez Garcia, and to give him some context, he is one of a category, if you will, of composers who were writing music in the Western Hemisphere at a time when Europe was dominated by the likes of Bach and Handel and Haydn and Mozart and Beethoven and so forth. And so not a lot of people in Europe knew about their work. And to be honest with you, not a lot of people today know about those composers and their work.
Yeah.
But I would say that if we want to make the broadest possible sort of conceptual base, we include even the people who were writing music in colonial America, people like William Billings and Jacob French and those folk. But there was musical activity going over here. So Nunez Garcia's dates are from 1767 to 1830. And so that makes him slightly younger, quite a bit younger than Haydn, slightly younger than Mozart, and has his dates a little bit more contemporaneous with Beethoven.
Right, very close.
He was the son of two parents who themselves were the children of slaves. And I think that's an important context also to establish here, that Brazil was part of the quote-unquote New World, and that the commonality, whether we're talking about the Portuguese, whose colony Brazil was, or the Spanish, or the English or the French, for that matter, the commonality is that in order to, and I would put this in air quotes, develop the New World, they needed labor. And that labor ended up coming from African slaves, eventually millions of African slaves brought to both the northern and the southern continent of the Americas.
Right.
And Brazil particularly relied very heavily on its influx of slaves to provide the labor that developed the country, that produced the crops, you know, things like sugar cane and so forth. And so Nunez Garcia was the grandson of slaves. And there's some irony there that this man who ended up developing such an eloquent mastery of the musical language of his day would not even have existed save for the fact of slavery. And so he showed musical talent at an early age. His parents realized this. His father died soon after he was born, early in his childhood. So his mother had to raise him. She, with the help of an aunt, raised him. He received instruction in music, but also in other subjects. It is thought that there was a family friend who was his first music instructor. But according to one of Nunez Garcia's biographers, at an early age, he was singing in the choir and had a beautiful, sweet voice, had what was reported to be an absolutely phenomenal memory, so that he could hear something and recall it. And as the biographer said, I better come close to quoting him, learned to play instruments like the harpsichord and the organ, which he was never taught to do. So he learned that on his own.
So that says something about his talent.
About his talent, yeah.
How did you come across this gentleman and his story? Actually, it's not a surprise that you came across his story, I suppose, but when did that happen and under what circumstances?
Just a great question. Because it was quite a bit earlier in my career when I became aware of him. I went to graduate school to Southern Illinois University in 1976, and sort of knew that there were contemporary or near-contemporary African-American composers, was sort of pretty acquainted with that group of composers, but had no idea about older composers of previous eras even, who were of African descent. And so almost as soon as I set foot in Southern Illinois, a gentleman there who was just a phenomenal person, who was instrumental in connecting me with that particular school, you know, and that's a whole story in itself, who went on later, after he left that faculty, to become the founder of the Center for Black Music Research. Samuel Floyd was doing this large event which brought together scholars and performers who would focus on the music of black composers. And so here I was listening to performance of pieces by black composers. Excerpts from the Requiem was a part of that performance. Present on that campus for that event was the Morgan State University Chorus, which was a phenomenal performing group. And they had recently recorded this entire Requiem with the Helsinki Symphony.
Hmm.
You know? And sort of guiding that through was a fabulous musicologist named Dominique René de Lerma. So it is the de Lerma edition, excerpts from the de Lerma edition of the Nunez Garcia that I first heard back then as a young, you know, grad student, and I sort of fell in love with the work. And so I'm real happy for the very first time to be able to conduct it with orchestra.
Wow. Was it hard to lay your hands on the actual score when it came time to perform this piece?
Well, not really hard. The vocal score, the choral vocal score, is readily available. It was originally published by Associated Music Publishers and is now available through Hale Leonard. And that's pretty easy to get. What was tougher to find was the full score and orchestral parts. And then I found out that there is at least another edition of that work. And as often happens when you're doing editions of works, even sometimes those of well-known composers, two editions may vary in significant respects. So I elected to do the edition that I was most acquainted with, which is de Lerma, and that was available on rental. And so we rented the score and we rented the parts in order to be able to do that. But the choral vocal score was pretty easy to get hold of.
Right. And we said earlier that he is roughly contemporary to Ludwig van Beethoven.
Mm-hmm.
So when we listen to this, do we think of Beethoven, or is this a distinctive voice all his own, and what is that voice?
That's terribly interesting. I think that if I were to simply, to use a term borrowed from an older technology, to needle drop that and ask you, who do you think wrote that? You know?
Right.
Or something my son and I, my 17-year-old and I sometimes do, and we're in the car and we come in and the work's already playing and we have no idea. So who do you think that's by? And, you probably would guess Mozart. Or the style is more Mozartian than it is maybe Beethoven-esque. And I have, in what limited opportunities I've had to understand more about the composer and his training and the context of this work, tried to figure out the answer to the question, how does a man who never sets foot outside of Brazil get to have such a really astounding mastery of the capital C classical music idiom. And I think some of that comes through his training. Some of that comes through his interaction with musicians. And so, of course, by Brazil being a Portuguese colony, there is some of that interaction going on. And another story is that it becomes really, really profuse in 1808, because in 1808, while the Napoleonic wars are going on in Europe, the entire Portuguese crown flees. I mean, they just get in their ships and they sail for America. I mean,
getting out of here.
Lock, stock, and barrel, getting out there. And so they then set up court in Brazil. And so they bring musicians and that sort of thing, too. The other answer to the development of style and Nunez Garcia's mastery of classical utterance, I think, also is found in the fact that we learned that they had a pretty good library in Rio de Janeiro, which is where he was. And, you know, he had a chance to study what was going on.
Okay.
But that's what I would say. I would say that if you listen to it, you hear, lots of similarities in the use of musical language to Mozart. And still, here and there, to my ear, a little bit more sort of leaned toward toward some romantic tendencies. Okay, now what we don't hear is we don't hear what we know to be or what I have found to be Brazilian folk influences. Interestingly, the Nunez Garcia biography says that early on he became more interested in Brazilian folk music, and that there was maybe some, even if subtle, political identification with the music of the people, because he became, I understand, quietly, of course, because he was so beholden to the Portuguese crown,
right,
but quietly an advocate for Brazilian independence, you know, which he did get to see in his lifetime.
Wow, fascinating. It just sounds like a tremendously interesting work, so out of the ordinary, and certainly a great, great story as well. So tell our listeners when these performances are going to occur of this intriguing rarity.
We will sing this on Friday, November 4th, and again Saturday, November 5th, at 7:30 p.m. each performance starts in the Francis Bedford Concert Hall in the Rita Talent Picken Regional Center for Arts and Humanities on the UW Parkside campus. And we will be joined, and this is important, we will be joined by the Milwaukee High School of the Arts Concert Chorale. This performance is the first in a series of performances which fall under the heading of Experiencing Choral Treasures. And the idea there is that we will collaborate with an outstanding high school choir in the region to bring them to campus and to do with them a work which they may not have been able to do by themselves, and to do it with orchestra and give them the opportunity to have what we think is a very high arts experience. And the MHSA chorale is really wonderful under the direction of Raymond Roberts. But again, it's tomorrow, Friday, November 4th, 7:30 p.m., Saturday, November 5th, 7:30 p.m. We sing the Milwaukee High School of the Arts Concert Chorale and the UW Parkside Choirs together with orchestra, the Requiem Mass of 1816 by Jose Mauricio Nunez Garcia.
It sounds like a lovely opportunity to hear a work that probably none of our listeners in their lives have ever heard before, and might not be a chance that comes again. So we're glad to hear about this opportunity. Dr. James Kinchin, Director of Choral Activities at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside, we appreciate you joining us for part one of today's morning show.
It's
Thank
my
you,
pleasure,
and best wishes.
Greg. Thank you so much.
Part two in a moment on WGTD. Two of today's morning show was supposed to be a conversation with Nick Baruti, and I recorded earlier this week, and I hope I'll be able to find that interview in order to bring it to you tomorrow. And otherwise, one way or another, we'll make proper acknowledgement of another interesting set of performances coming up this weekend, tomorrow night and Saturday night, both 7:30 p.m., by the Bell Ensemble of Racine, Hugo Distler's Totentanz, or Dance of Death, with collaboration of local actors, directed by Marine Cashin-Bolog. And we had a conversation, and it sounds like a very, very intriguing work as well. Friday night at Holy Communion Lutheran Church in Racine, Saturday night at St. Matthew's Episcopal Church in Kenosha. Again, please tune in for tomorrow's morning show. One way or another, we will share with you more information about that intriguing concert as well. But in the meantime, from the archives, here's part two of today's morning show here on WGTD. As many of you know, my full-time job is as assistant professor of music over at Carthage College. And so you can understand the special delight and fascination I had in reading a new book called My Freshman Year, What a Professor Learned by Becoming a Student. The author, Rebecca Nathan, is actually an anthropology professor at a large university, but found herself, in a sense, increasingly baffled by her students, by what made them tick, and in particular, what forces were at play that sometimes kept some of them from really working to their full potential. What were the other things in their lives that were keeping them from doing as well as they could in the classroom with what should have been their central work? So she did what anthropologists do when they want to study a given population. She went and lived among them. In this case, impersonating a freshman student. Maybe that's not even the right word. She became
probably not the right word.
Yeah, she became a freshman student and then studied very carefully those around her and wrote about it in this book called My Freshman Year, What a Professor Learned by Becoming a Student, published by Penguin Books. And Rebecca Nathan, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you so much, Greg.
Really glad to have you here. At one point in the book, you liken this experience, or maybe someone you know likened it, to that experiment that was undertaken some years ago by someone who injected themselves with some sort of dye and tried to live as a black man. Compare this experience to that one.
Well, I brought it up in the book just because I think the comparison is a little overdrawn, you know, and that that it's interesting that so many people saw it that way because they saw what going back, a professor becoming a student, is as radical as changing your race. So I did think that was kind of funny. In some ways, it was very radical for me. I didn't expect to learn as much as I did learn from the student point of view, because when you walk and act like a student and you take five classes and you live in the dorm and you try to be in clubs and you try to have a social life as well at the university, you really see how difficult school can be. And I really learned from doing it that way, just the multiple demands that were really on my life, and I came to have a lot more compassion for my student's position.
You ended up registering for classes and taking classes and living in a dorm. I mean, absolutely living the life of a college freshman. And
I did.
What was so intriguing is, on one level, of course, you knew a lot about college freshmen. You dealt with them all the time. But as a teacher to students and not as a peer, you talk at one point about how this experience of becoming a student yourself was sort of like stepping through the looking glass. And all of the sudden you were encountering these students and connecting with them. I mean, not the very same students, but similar students, connecting with them in an entirely different way. And knowing so much more about their world, a world which they didn't share with you when they knew you were the teacher.
That's right. And it's not, you know, it's not only that they shared with me, it's that I got to walk in their shoes. That was probably what I learned most from, was just having to do what I asked them to do. And I just found that it was more difficult. I was not a straight A student. My colleagues are very surprised. I found it an organizational nightmare to have to take five separate classes and do all the diverse things that students are doing today, which is different from when I went to school. Most students now, in addition to taking their five classes and then they're being in professional groups and in volunteer groups because they're worried about what things are going to look like. They don't only need the degree, they need more things on their resume when they get out. They feel that way, that there's more competition. And so they're doing more things like that. They're also partying and having a social life. But what's different is that they're also working. And that's 10 to 20 hours a week, many of them. And that was something very different from when I went to school.
As you said about doing this work as an anthropologist, you call yourself a participant-observer.
Yes.
Which, of course, is really challenging then. I mean, for you to take on the work burden of a typical college student and at the same time having to be especially observant of it and writing about it. Tell us especially about this matter of field notes. I mean, how did you compile all the information which you were taking in as an observer?
Well, every night for myself, I would kind of write my own diary. And that was the stories of what happened to me during the day and my life as a student. And then I also interviewed students, and that I waited till my second semester to do. I interviewed students and I did focus groups. Now, those were done through the more normal research protocol that an observer would have to go through. So then I would sit them down and tell them that I was writing this for a book, and could I have their permission to do this interview and use their words or their stories. And so for that, I got a kind of, permission to be able to do that, and those were more formal interviews. But a lot of what I was doing was keeping my own diary and then taking note of all the things in public space that I could, the things on the wall, the things on the doors, on the outside of the doors, that face the hall, the way the cafeteria, people ate and sat in the cafeteria. Things that were available in public space were also very much part of my note-taking.
And some of the most fascinating stuff in the book. Let's talk for a moment about the things that people would put on their dorm room doors or the little bulletin boards beside them, the kind of pictures which would post. I mean, you took the time to really look at those kind of things and to try to figure out why students were choosing to post the particular pictures which they did. It's such an interesting matter.
Right, and it's a really cultural rather than psychological thing. And I think if you ask most students, and I have since in my classes, they'll say, hey, this doesn't mean anything. It just is somebody's interest areas is what they put up on the door. But when you really look at it as an anthropologist, which is different, you really see patterning. You see that it's not just interest. There's only certain kinds of pictures that go up on the doors. And those pictures tend to be me partying, me with my friends, me in crazy positions, me with my tongue sticking out, me with, that's kind of the pictures that go up on the door. Or music posters, celebrities go up on the door, good-looking men and women, badly clothed, go up on the door. Those things, your picture of your mother doesn't go up on the door. It does go in your dorm room, but it's not the public image that you want to convey. Want to convey freedom and individuality and coolness.
You say many of the photos, just as the words, phrases, and images included, are calculated to say something like, here I am doing crazy, spontaneous, fun things. Here I am having a good time with my friends, or sometimes I'm a unique and eccentric individual.
Absolutely.
But even that is sort of a calculated plan to tell the world what you want them to think of you.
Yes, and that eccentric thing is so, is so true, because in my own classes now, one of the things I'll do is take people, after they've read this, take them to the dorm room and let them look at the doors and let them do the analysis. And what surprises me is that they say, I never saw it that way before. And now that I see it that way, I can't stop seeing it that way. And I realize that my own door that I thought is so different and unique really has these same properties.
Right. You know, I think of my office door and my office where I teach, and I sometimes find myself thinking about it differently. Have I covered my office door with all kinds of funny cartoons and crazy pictures and this and that in order to make some kind of statement to the world about who I am?
I'm sure you have. And, you know, and we make a faculty statement about who we are, because if you look at our doors, that would be a great study for some student to compare faculty doors and student doors, and you'd see different values being represented.
Absolutely. You talk about how that first week before classes start, when everyone's just on campus, that it's this kind of beehive of activity, all kinds of things planned, but that as soon as classes start, campus life becomes something very different, and sort of real life goes on. People retreat to their own lives, to their insular social groups. And at that point, it became quite a challenge for you to, in your words, get the sense of the rhythm of people's lives. And I guess it partly comes down to the fact that everyone has a different rhythm going on. Everyone's living a slightly different life at that point.
Yes, and, you know, the contrast between, this is really structured by the way our society works and the way our universities now work. The big university that has so many options in it that you could have 1,000 different people, each living a different schedule. And it really was brought home to me by a Korean student who said to me after the first week, she was also a first-year student like myself, and she said, I can't understand how to get involved with anybody. And I said, well, what do you mean? And she said, well, in Korea, when we finish a class, everybody goes out to lunch together. And here, the minute the bell rings, everyone's gone and they scatter. And I just saw in that some cultural things about us, that we do so much with choice and the ability to go and come as you want and take classes at the times that you want, that we end up having schedules that really don't overlap that much. And it's hard to get together for meals and to be able to do the rest of it.
Yeah,
you
people
really have to think about it.
Right, have to really make decisions towards that end. You also talk about how this really flies in the face of what many colleges, certainly my college, likes to talk about, this idea of community. But you say it is hard to create community when the sheer number of options in college life generate a system in which no one is in the same place at the same time.
Yeah.
I mean, there is this incredible complexity to what someone called the over-optioned public university or college system.
Yeah.
And the sense of cohesiveness which one might sense in a tightly knit community, that is all but impossible to achieve in this kind of scenario.
Well, it is, but I think that universities are now wrestling with that same question across the country. I'm talking at maybe 25 universities this year that are calling me and say, you know, we see the same problem. What are you guys doing? What are you guys doing? I think we're all trying to address how to make a sense of community and a little university within these big universities that we have. And there are various ways that different colleges are trying to do that, often by having living and learning environments where people who live together will also take classes together and to have meals together. And I think the freshman year experiences, that they're trying to make them more community-based.
Hmm. You talk about how often things will be put together that are either community, campus-wide, or at least all the freshmen will maybe have to take a given seminar course. But you talk about how almost always any sort of required common experience is terribly unpopular. I mean,
yeah.
This is a real
uphill battle in a sense.
Right, and that's the rub, and it has to do with not just students today, but it's the nature of the United States and the country we live in. We value so much this idea of individual choice that it's very hard for people to accept that there's one thing that they have to do, and that it's required, and that they don't get any choice within that.
Well, you touch on a real truth here, which is that college students are just a reflection of our overall society.
Indeed.
And you say, when you talk about people, wherever they might be, they might genuinely want to have a close community, while at the same time, they resist the claims that community makes on their schedule and resources. That's in the name of individualism, spontaneity, freedom, and choice. Those are all things that we all love, but
right.
they come at a price, in a sense.
Right, and it's a real tension within our lives, even as adults.
One thing, too, in terms of this idea of community on a college campus, you talk about how certain things will pull students in, things like Greek organizations, fraternities, and sororities, and create what I guess one person called little loyalties, in which around people will gather. I think someone else talked about the orbital energy that is part of some of these smaller organizations, but that small circle might be in itself its own community, but in a sense it also is pulling students and their attention away from the greater community that one might want to create.
That's right. It's the same tension over again. The very ways that we think of at universities to create these small communities sometimes pulls people away. This is some of the argument that's being made against Greek systems, but it's also against systems like black student unions that say it's pulling those students away. The only argument I have with that for something like a black student union is that, at least in my research, I found that students of color in general are mixing much more with people different from themselves than white students are. And it's in part the numbers involved at most universities, but if you look at the eating arrangements or you look at the social networks of students, and this is really a disturbing factor for some of us who are very committed to diversity at the university, we would expect that there's much more of social groups and eating together that are going to be mixed because classes are mixed. But what you find really is that when students go to eat together in the university cafeteria, that it's not as mixed as you would want it to be.
I want you to tell our listeners about one adjustment you made when you really started studying this question of diversity and asking students, who are your friends? And do you have friends here at this college or university that are from another ethnic group? You ended up, I think, midway through your study kind of playing with the questions you were asking or the way you were asking the question, and it made quite a difference.
I did, because I realized at some point that when I said, do you have people in your social network who are different from yourselves ethnically, I would get a PC answer. I would get the answer that people thought was the right thing to say, which is, absolutely I do. And then I would ask them for a name of that student, and they would say, John from my economics class. He's a good friend of mine, and he's a person of color, or he's a white person, and the person talking to me is a person of color. And what I found when I just didn't notice that. I didn't see that happening as much as people said it was true in their social networks. I didn't see it in the lunchroom. And so I thought to change the question. And instead of asking them that, I asked them, who are your closest friends? And they would name 5 people, 6 people, 7 people. And I would take all those names, and then later in my interview, I would ask them about their ethnic background, about their majors, about their other things about that student.
Those friends that they listed.
Right, I'm sorry, those friends. And what I found out doing it that way is that people really gravitate to their own and that their social networks are really pretty much people like them. And again, it was less true for people of color. And that's why I think special student unions and special programs are good for students of color who are often in the minority and therefore always interacting with people different from themselves. Hmm. It's the white students who aren't.
So that really puts that in a different light.
That
maybe these ethnically based unions, like a black student union, are giving them something which they otherwise are not experiencing in the day-to-day.
That's right.
They're experiencing more diversity in their social circles than the typical white student, for instance.
Exactly.
But that helps explain this need.
Exactly, and that's made me think about these issues differently, and that it's not a blanket policy that we do or we don't have these organizations. It seems like we should and we shouldn't, depending on what those organizations are.
And a corollary to what you're just saying in terms of us gravitating to who is like us, you tell many different stories about how, on Super Bowl Sunday, your particular RA would set up a couple of giant screen televisions in the lounge.
Right.
And, there might be three people that would show up for that sort of community event. And you'd find all kinds of clusters of students gathered in their own dorm rooms with their own tight circle of friends watching the Super Bowl.
You know, that's absolutely true. And it was one of my biggest insights in this freshman year was that Super Bowl experience. Because what it showed me, and you have to understand that this was in an upper-class dorm. This was not in a freshman dorm. What I hear from the freshmen really is that, and really from freshman advisors too, is that freshmen do have community, but they have it for a limited time. And what the people at my university say is once you come to spring break of the first year, that's kind of the cutoff point. Sometimes it happens as early as Thanksgiving. But it's the time when people are open to that larger community, and they're trying to make these networks. They're trying to make these friends. But then once they do, and they pretty much do during their freshman year, the deed is done. And they often keep those same networks throughout their college career. And what it makes me think about as a professor is how I could help to mix it up a little bit, how I could introduce them to more people, because they really are staying with the people that they've met early, and the people they've met early are often the people just like them.
Hmm. When we start getting into matters more academic than social, you really discovered some interesting things as well. And one of them, you seem to develop a real appreciation for what your students had been living through. The fact that a given student in a college is subject to a number of different masters.
Yeah.
You said, as a student, I was quick to learn you serve many masters, each with his or her own quirks, schedules, and predilections. And up to then, you hadn't thought much about that. You mostly just thought about your classes, your students, and the demands you were making, not real cognizant of the other demands which were being made on those same students by other teachers in other classrooms.
And absolutely. I mean, all my rules and my way of doing things are to make my classes work. And I really didn't think of all the other things that were being demanded of them in other classes.
You talk about... This is Rebecca Nation, and this is the author of this book called American Nation. Tomorrow on The Morning Show, we will be talking politics, and we'll be talking to two different candidates who are running for office in this election cycle. We reached out to their incumbents, whom they are opposing, but received no response. But we will be sharing with you conversations recorded with Andy Mitchell and with Ryan Solon.
That will be on tomorrow's morning show. The morning show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. The program is archived at WGTD.org. Support for WGTD's morning show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenosians who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Mr. Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago and later served as station manager and occasional morning show co-host.